the great American tradition of pursuing happiness.
A seeker is someone on the road to find out. A seeker is someone trying to, say, make the country live up to its ideals. A seeker is trying to get to a better place in their life. All history is the history of longing. And in Chasing Eden, each chapter is a history of longing. Each chapter is a story of seekers.
That's Howard Mansfield. We spend the hour with him first talking about his new book, Chasing Eden, A Book of Seekers. It's about those who long to build a better life for themselves and others. Then we replay our 2019 interview with Mansfield about his book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. It's about how American society treats property rights and who pays the price. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net for episode 803. I'm Francesca Rihanna. It's a cliche that America is the place where people reinvent themselves, seeking a better life for themselves and often others. It's a theme that, in one way or another, runs through many of Howard Mansfield's wonderful books. But in Chasing Eden, out in October 2021 from Bowen Press, he drills down into the stories of some quintessential American seekers. They include a young man shepherding the last of the Shakers through their twilight years, an African-American doctor who achieves the American dream by changing the boundaries of the color line, crossing over and back, rewriting the definition of race, and 40,000 Africans, newly freed from slavery in the U.S., taking possession of the 40 acres promised them, only to have their land ripped away from them within months. These and other stories in Chasing Eden take us on a journey through the ways Americans have gone in pursuit of happiness. They prompt us to contemplate our own pursuit with its costs and rewards. Howard Mansfield is the author of some 10 books. His articles and essays have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, American Heritage, and many other publications. Howard Mansfield, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's really terrific to be here.
This is the third book of yours that we've spoken to you about, Chasing Eden, A Book of Seekers. The first two were Dwelling in Possibility and The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. That latter one was about citizen action against natural gas pipelines and transmission towers that were going through their neighborhoods. Do you see a common theme or themes running through these books?
Yeah, they're all about the pursuit of happiness, which is, you know, Jefferson, when Jefferson wrote those words, he set the primary occupation of every American up, you know, the pursuit of happiness. They're all about seeking. They're all about Americans trying to find the promised land, and what exists alongside the promised land is the promise denied. So I think those themes unite it.
The promise sought and the promise denied. So what is a seeker?
A seeker is someone on the road to find out. A seeker is someone trying to, say, make the country live up to its ideals. A seeker is trying to get to a better place in their life. I can best explain it by telling you why I started to write this book. The last years of political turmoil set me to thinking about things, of course. And I was reading about a time in the middle of the 19th century when America was a fluid, roiling experiment. Things were open. People were trying to solve things. There were new religions, new utopias. Social movements started that have shaped us down to this day. Women's rights, temperance, abolition movement. And things were so active that in 1840, Ralph Waldo Emerson writes to his good friend Thomas Carlyle, and he says, we're all a little wild here with numberless projects of social reform. There is hardly a reader that doesn't have a plan for a new social community in his waist pocket. So that kind of openness appealed to me. And then I was reading about another era of reform, the progressive era, you know, the era that gave us, you know, eventually the 8-hour day and child labor laws and the push for the woman's vote and several amendments to the Constitution. And it's a terrific historian, Jackson Lears. And Lears writes in the very first sentence of his book, the very first sentence, he says, all history is the history of longing. And, you know, anytime anybody says all X is Y, you kind of fold your head and say, come on, really? All that is everything? But about the Progressive Era and about our very own era right now, Lears is right. All history is the history of longing. And in Chasing Eden, each chapter is a history of longing. Each chapter is a story of seekers. And there's three primary things people are seeking in the book, and the book's in three parts. They're seeking God, they're seeking freedom, and they're seeking peace.
And they are wonderful stories, beautifully told. You start talking about religious movements. You start with the Shakers. I've always been fascinated by the Shakers. Maybe not the only, but probably the most important communist experiment in the United States ever.
Yes, and the most successful utopia. The people of faith were really hold it together for a really long time. I think at their peak in the middle of the 19th century, there were about 6,000 Shakers in something like 20 different communities. And it gets down to just a few communities, and one of them in the 20th century, and one of them along the 1950s is Canterbury Shaker Village, which is just north of the state capital, Concord, in New Hampshire. And they're down to about 14 sisters living in about 50 buildings on several hundred or several thousand acres. So the end times is coming for them. And along shows up this fellow I write about in the chapter, Bud Thompson. He's 31 years old. He's a strapping guy. He's a folk singer. He's looking for folk songs. He also had been a singing cowboy had his own little radio show in Boston when he was a teenager, even though he's like from Rhode Island, you know, but he was a singing cowboy, not even Western Rhode Island. But he shows up there and the Shakers and him hit it off. It's a love story, really. They just admired him. He admires the Shakers. And he's the one who convinced them not to just shut this whole thing down, sell off the land, but to create a museum, an outdoor museum, as it would have been said at the time, so that the Shaker people could still come and contemplate the Shaker ideals. And it's just a fantastic meeting of the two.
Yeah, and tell us about the sisters as well. You know, I think a lot of people have a view of the Shakers, you know, especially at the end, that they were, you know, that it was a failure. They were the pathetic spinsters, you know, but.
Exactly. And that's the way they're portrayed. I mean, you could see a Life magazine did it, a story. I think it was the 30s. And they just look like dour, failed, you know, these ladies in these old 19th century dresses and these bonnets. But they had a phenomenal sense of humor. They had phenomenal faith. And they had a deep understanding of people and what people were seeking when they came to visit, and surprisingly, of children. So here's what struck me. I mean, I spent months talking to Bud and Bud's sons and working in the archives, a fantastic archives there and a fantastic archivist. I read the Shaker scholars, but I wasn't really like getting deeper into the Shakers and deep enough to write about them because they've been written about a lot. Well, in 1960, one of the many things Bud Thompson did was to record the Shaker sisters at Canterbury and some brothers over at Sabbath Day Lake in Maine. And they were talking about how they came to Shaker Village, what their Shaker faith was, what they thought the spirit life was. So I found them online. I downloaded them, put them on my iPod. I was, you know, standing in the middle of the gym, you know, with my iPod plugged in, and, you know, the TV sets are going, Fox, CNN, Home Destruction Channel, music's playing. And all of a sudden, I'm listening to a woman who was born in 1876 speak to me. And her voice is very precise. The words are very chiseled. We might say her word usage is archaic, but it's a very different way of talking than the way we're talking to each other right now. And what she says is she came to Shaker Village as an orphan. Then I listened to the next Shaker and the next. And I realized in that era, in the late 1950s, when Bud was there, when there were about a dozen or 14 Shaker sisters, they were all orphans except for one. So at Canterbury Shaker Village in that era was an orphan's utopia, and they created a perfect world. And while at that time they were not taking in children regularly anymore, they were taking in children every now and then. And they had this deep understanding of children. It was just really moving. And their faith was actually kind of very quiet, even though they could no longer shake and pray in the way they could in the meeting house. Bud still drove them to church, I think in Laconia, which is a city nearby. So they remained true to the end. Of what they were, their Shaker faith held right to the end. If you go to that place, if you go to Canterbury Shaker Village, it's just such a sense of peace up there. It's, you feel like something happened here, something very different happened here.
And tell the story. Now, I don't remember her name, but I think one of the last orphans to come who had, you know, just come from the most terrible abuse. You know, she just never thought anybody would love her. Talk about the meeting, her first meeting as she's brought there.
Yeah, yeah. The sister who adopted her called her Birdie. I'm trying to remember the sister's name now. Yeah, Marguerite, and she was Alberta. And, you know, they weren't taking in children at the time, but, you know, they would ask the sisters before Christmas, what do you want for Christmas, right? And she wrote, like, a little girl, a little girl, a little girl. So, and, you know, they didn't want to do it, but finally they did, and she arrived. Marguerite arrived, and she'd been abused. She'd been orphaned. She'd been passed from house to house. She'd been living in one family that, you know, wouldn't serve her dessert, but made her watching serving dessert. She'd been beaten. And she was just trembling with fear. She thought, oh, she's not going to like me. I'm going to be no good. And she was like hiding behind the couch. When Sister Marguerite heard that she was here, and so she came, it was the middle of winter, it was like December, this time of year, actually, came running down the path to see her, like her, you know, her bonnet almost flying on, gets in, runs over to this frightened little girl and just hugs her. And no one had hugged this little girl since her mother had died. It had been like, what, 7, 8, 9, 10 years? And she just believed that this little girl was a good girl. And Alberta said, she made me into that good girl. She believed in me. She always called her Birdie for some reason. Maybe out of Alberta, Birdie. I'm not sure. And then when Alberta got older, you know, kind of teenage, she said, you know, you have to go out. You do have to go out into the world. If you just stay here, you'll be taking care of a lot of old ladies, a lot of young ladies. It's your time to shine. Go fly. So what a gift that is to have raised this young lady up and then to have sent her out into the world. It's just, it's very moving. You know, June Sprigg, who was this fantastic Shaker scholar and curated those shows that were just packed in the 90s about Shaker furniture and Shaker art, said, you know, that was the best thing the Shakers ever did. You know, forget the chairs and the boxes and inventing the circular saw and the package seats. That was just an amazing thing that they did.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Howard Mansfield about his new book, Chasing Eden. And then you turn your lens to a doctor, a very successful doctor.
Yes.
A black doctor who passed for white. Tell us about him.
Dr. Albert Johnston gets admitted to the Rush Medical School in University of Chicago. It's like 1926, class of 26. They accept the entire medical school class, two people of color. He's one of the two. You know, very genial guy, really smart guy, later on a terrific doctor. Okay, but to be a doctor, once you do your medical education, you have to finish it by being an intern. We all know that. So no white hospitals would have him because he was a person of color. And they had, at the time, 4 Negro hospitals, as they called them. And his school said, no, we're not accepting any of them anyway. So what's he going to do? He applies to 31 different places. He takes short on money, takes the train to someplace in Worcester. They say, you're qualified. And then they look at him and say, nope, can't take it. Over and over and over. Finally, he arrives in Portland, Maine. They don't ask. He doesn't tell. And he's a doctor. He's an intern and he's a doctor. Now he's passed, as the expression has it. Didn't intend to pass. It's what he had to do to become a doctor. So the years go by. His family, he becomes a much beloved family doctor up in Gorham during the Depression, which is up in the White Mountains. Then becomes a radiologist, goes down the city of Keene, which is the southwest part of New Hampshire, over towards Vermont. And then for complicated reasons that are in the book, the family decides to tell its story. And they tell it in the most public way possible in 1947 in Reader's Digest, which at the time claimed it was as read in the world as the Bible. It was just everywhere. And then they top that. 2 years later, they told it in a movie called Lost Boundaries. And this movie was a landmark movie. It was made by this fellow, Louis de Rochemont, who had produced the March of Time newsreels that people go see in the movie theater. He created the whole thing because at the time, everything was just over the radio. You go to the theater, you'd see Hitler invading Poland. You'd see sharecroppers. Incredible kind of thing. And he made this film. And to make this film, he had to mortgage his farm, everything. And it's one of the very first movies that treats Black Americans as serious adults with serious problems. They're not mammies. They're not step and fetch it. They're not all these awful things. The film, I think it's Jose Ferrer's first movie, apparently.
A white man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And he shoots it in this documentary style using like real old time Yankees over in Portsmouth and Kennebunkport and Kittery, Maine. And you look at the, and it's black and white, and you look at the film today, it almost has this fable-like quality. And it's a terrific, serious, quiet movie, and a landmark movie that was much debated. It was like banned in the South. It was debated in the black community. Ralph Ellison writes a fascinating, penetrating critique and appreciation of it at the same time. So all that happened. And so what that chapter's about is what the cost of passing took, what that cost the family and how, and the community around them, and what Keen thought, which was a white place then and is a still a white place, when their doctor, they found out was, you know, a person of color. And how did they react and not react? That's what that chapter is about.
Yeah, and talk about the losses. They're on, and more generalized, the losses of passing on both sides of that boundary.
Yeah, well, to pass, they had to cut themselves off from the black community. So they didn't want their kids to know that they were black. And they didn't want anybody in Gorham or Keene early on to know that. So when they would go down to Boston to visit relatives, they would leave their kids behind and they wouldn't have those people come up and visit. So over time, you become divorced from who you are and part of who you are. There's a terrific scholar, Alison Hobbs, who wrote an excellent history of passing, which she called A Chosen Exile, which is, and she says passing is exile. So while, say, other immigrants, they say Italian-Americans, Jewish-Americans, could, as we say today, code switch and decide how Italian or Jewish they want to be in a particular situation and climb up the social ladder, change their name or not. That, when Dr. Johnson went up the social ladder, climbed up the ladder, he was told, oh, no, you're black. You can't do that. So it's a complicated, painful history. And it plays out and is shown in the movie and in the story and in what happens with their children as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're Jewish. I am as well. Neither of us have Jewish last names.
Oh, yes.
It occurred to me it's a form of passing as well.
You know, it is. It is. It's very curious. It definitely is. I mean, it's just this is the family name as it, you know, migrated from Eastern Europe and came through Ellis Island. And here it is.
Right. Now, the most heart-wrenching chapter in this wonderful book, Howard Mansfield, In Chasing Eden, is the one of 40 acres and a mule. It's a story of the Freedmen's Bureau and what happened to the black farmers who were promised land, who got land, and then lost it. It's a story of terrible betrayal. Tell us it.
It is. And this is a story, I think, if people understand this episode from Reconstruction, the period right after the Civil War down south. If you can understand that and what happened and what didn't happen, you understand how we get to today and today's inequality and the huge disparities in wealth between white households and black households and what the Black Lives Movement is saying. So this is what happened. Some people do know this story. Some people don't. Towards the end of the Civil War, Sherman gets to Savannah, Christmas, actually, right before Christmas, 1864, writes, Lincoln says, I've split the South in two. Here's your Christmas present, Savannah. Secretary of War Stanton says, that's great. I'm coming down on a steamer and talking to you, Sherman. And why? Well, Stanton was a devoted abolitionist. Sherman was not. Sherman was a white supremacist. Sherman was awful in that way. The Union Army, towards the end of the Civil War, was 10%. African-American, 10%. The 60,000 men under Sherman's command, 60,000 men, his army, 0%. Stanton was going down there with the black regiment to talk to Sherman about that. So when Stanton gets there to Savannah, he says, you know what? I want to meet leaders of the black community. This is unprecedented. No one asked them what they wanted. I want to know what they want. So Sherman convenes 20 black men. They're aged 20 to 70. They're Baptist ministers. They're Methodist ministers. They're a smart group. Five had bought their way out of freedom. Seven were freeborn. Here they were. And Stanton asks a dozen questions for them. Ask them, first question, you know, what do you understand by freedom? And they say, you know, freedom is benefiting by our own work. Freedom is working for ourselves. You know, freedom is, you know, being able to pursue our lives by ourselves. And the second, and the second question Stan Tan said, well, ask him is, well, what do you need? What do you want? And he said, we want land to till and toil with our own labor and eventually to buy that land and then support ourselves and our government. So Sherman and Stan sit down right after this meeting, and Sherman writes a pretty famous or semi-famous military field order, Special Order 15. And that grants 40 acres of land to every freeman and a swath of land from Charleston down to the St. John's River in Florida and about 30 miles inland. 40 acres. The mule came later. The mule was an add-on. Sherman had all captured a lot of broken down horses and mules and was just wanting to get rid of them. So right away, under direction of another abolitionist general, 40,000 freedmen are settled. Like that. They have land. They have a start. They have something. 40,000. Big number. However, there had been 4 million enslaved in the South. 4 million. So 40,000 number, 40,000, small number. But it's a start. And it's just getting going. April 1865, you know, Lincoln is murdered. Andrew Johnson comes in. Andrew Johnson is determined to get all the land back to the plantation owners as fast as possible. Andrew Johnson hates the Freedmen's Bureau, which you just mentioned. The Freedmen's Bureau was the most audacious, widespread, ambitious social program agency the government had attempted until the time of the New Deal. It was supposed to create a market, a free market for labor where there had been none. It was supposed to start schools for the free blacks where there had been none. It was supposed to feed and clothe the insane, the ill, the indigent, white or black. It was supposed to ensure their civil rights. It was supposed to set up a separate court system. It was supposed to do all this, and it had zero budget. It was supposed to live on land it rented out. It was run by army officers, and it had passed Congress by only two votes. So it sets out hated. Johnson hates the Freedmen's Bureau. There's a general put in charge of it, General O.O. Howard, lost an arm in the Civil War, fights in Antietam, fights in Gettysburg, commands the right flank of Sherman's army in the march through Georgia. He's the Christian general. He has this tremendous religious conversion at age 26. He thinks reason and good faith will prevail. He's in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau. Johnson outflanks him at every point. And the central point in the chapter is a one day in the middle of October 1865, when Johnson has sent General O.O. Howard down south to a Disto Island, one of the sea islands off Charleston, off South Carolina, to throw the freedmen off their land, where they've been prospering and growing a good crop and been reasonably happy. And there's this tremendous scene in the church where 2,000 of them hear this man they have put their faith in, come down and tell them, no, you have to leave. This is over. And they sing, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. And General O.O. Howard's up there crying. And still, he goes back to Washington. He tries to secure land for them. He goes to Congress, goes to Johnson, goes back to Congress. He fails and he fails and he fails. And the freedmen throw it off their land. And this positive, possible revolutionary episode is squashed. And all through the South, the freedmen have thrown off their land. W.E.B. Du Bois, the great scholar of the Reconstruction early on in the 1930s, said, you know, if all these Negro families, it was like 1 million families, had been given a freehold, land to hold, what a beacon of democracy, what a model for the rest of the world that would have been. And which he doesn't say, but which we know now, how different things could be today. That's the story of 40 Acres of the Mule.
Exactly. I mean, it seems that this, we are, reaping the whirlwind of our original sin, which is slavery. And every time that Black and Brown Americans make any gains, the backlash is fierce.
Absolutely. And a lot of it's the unfinished work of Reconstruction. It's what we didn't do at the end of the Civil War to try and make up for this horror, to try and set things on a better course. It's a wrench. I tell you, it's a wrenching story to read. Student of American history, I knew about Reconstruction, but I didn't know how violent the South was after the war, how unlawful it was, how many slaveholders were still holding on to slaves a year and a half later in some places. It was brutal. It was brutal. The Freedmen's Bureau was widely seen as a failure, although W.E.B. Du Bois had seen the opposite. It was a noble experiment that just should have been given more room to run, more funding, obviously. So, someone seeking a walk.
You also we don't really have time to go into it, but you do talk about the real story of Thanksgiving. You know, the pilgrims were seekers, yes, but that seeking meant that others paid a terrible price. And it seems that in many of these stories, seeking ends in the dispossession of somebody else.
It does, doesn't it? Someone else pointed that out to me. The story of Thanksgiving, which, by the way, we celebrate because of a footnote, misidentifying it as a time of Thanksgiving where it was just a harvest feast. But the story of Thanksgiving is an optical trick. It takes this one moment of amity, this one moment of celebration among the Wampanoags and the people we call the pilgrims, the separatists, and uses it to cover over all this distrust and strife and warfare and massacres that happen in the 75 years afterwards. And it makes it seem, as a Native scholar and friend of mine at once pointed out, that, oh, okay, come on, we welcomed you, we wanted you here, we wanted you to come here and take over our land. Which, as she says in the chapter, no, that's not what we wanted. We just wanted you to understand who we were and how we lived here. And we wanted to be allies. And we always looked after the stranger. So basically, Thanksgiving is lacking in gratitude when you get right down to it. It's a word we're all throwing around right now. But that's what's missing in our Thanksgiving. The real story, if it was properly understood, I think would lead us to a sense of gratitude and a sense of who we've displaced to be here as well.
Right. And the need to repair.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to start thinking about that. And not that there are easy answers to that, but let's have that the discussion around the festival table there, you know, Thanksgiving table.
Well, this is just a beautifully written series of essays on the theme, Chasing Eden, a book of seekers. There are several stories that we didn't get to. They're all wonderful. Howard Mansfield, thank you so much for coming back to Writer's Voice to talk about this wonderful book.
Oh, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our talk. It was great fun.
Howard Mansfield. Stay tuned as we air our 2019 interview with him about the book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with Howard Mansfield, cultural historian extraordinaire. We just heard our most recent interview with him talking about Chasing Eden. Now let's hear my 2019 conversation with Mansfield about the habit of turning the world upside down. In America, private property is supposed to be sacred. But whose private property is sacred? Is the land of ranchers and farmers on the U.S. southern border sacred when Donald Trump wants it to build his wall on? Is the land of West Virginians and Pennsylvanians sacred when gas companies take it to drill and frack gas? Or how about people in New Hampshire and Massachusetts when oil and gas companies take it for their pipelines? While reporting on citizens fighting natural gas pipelines and transmission towers planned to cut right across their homes, author Howard Mansfield saw the emotional toll of these projects. This was about more than kilowatts, power lines, and pipelines, he writes. Something in this upheaval felt familiar. I began to realize that I was witnessing an essential American experience. The world turned upside down. And it all turned on one word, property. His new book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, tells the stories of Americans living in a time in which everything is in motion, in which the world will be turned upside down again and again. The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down is out from Bowen Press. Well, Howard Mansfield, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
I found this book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, as a book that I have been looking for to be written for many years. So I am so glad that you wrote it. I think it's about a very important subject. But before we get to the subject, I'm going to ask you, why The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down?
Well, it's the way we regard the world. It's the way we treat land. It's the way we regard property. And it comes from something Alexis de Tocqueville said. You know, de Tocqueville wrote the famous book, Democracy in America. And he came here in 1831. It was a young country. De Tocqueville's a young man. He's an aristocrat. He's like 26 or 27. He's running around interviewing all sorts of Americans. And he makes this note in his journals after talking with one American diplomat. And de Tocqueville says this: "It would seem that the habit of changing place, of turning things upside down, of cutting, of destroying, has become a necessity of the American's existence." Alexis de Tocqueville, 1831. And that is, I think, goes right to the heart of our attitude towards land and what we think land and property is for and how we've developed the country.
You say that property is our pyramids and our Parthenon. What do you mean by that?
It's our great creation. I think you have to understand how property in America is different and how it changed from what property was before in the feudal ages. In feudalism, if your family had property, had land, you couldn't sell it. Land was the family. And you had all these obligations by all these terms that are now lost to us, escussage, burgage, francomelian, knight service, so forth, types of cordy, so forth. And then when it came to America, all that was thrown out, and property became a commodity. In fact, there's a famous legal historian who said, American law favors property in motion, or at risk, rather than property secure and at rest. And that's the American system. The American system is a sign in a lot by the road that says 1 acre, zone commercial, will build to suit. And the great historian of the Revolution, Gordon Estwood, he said this: "Indeed, the great change that Americans made in their understanding of property can explain the American Revolution." It's like, whoa! So it was that fundamental a change. And that around us is so invisible, I say in the book, it's like property is the air we breathe. All those assumptions about property we never think about, and so it affects not only how we think about the world, but even what we even let ourselves think about. It defines everything. It's, in fact, our boundaries.
You know, it's so interesting because you take something that we just take for granted and show that it's really something that is very particular to a time and a place in history, in the founding of America, and now, you know, has in many ways taken over the world. This country was supposed to be founded on the sacredness of private property, which is, you know, something that you talk about, but this book really asks, whose private property is sacred?
Well, it's exactly that way from the start. If you're obviously a white male and have property, you can vote. So you have property rights. But the Indians, the Native Americans who they encountered, were not thought of as having property rights. In fact, the Puritan John Winthrop says in 1628, you know, the Indians, you know, they have no settled habitation, neither do they cultivate the land or have any tame cattle. So therefore, in his view, they were not following the injunction, I think it's in Genesis 1:28, which is, you know, to have a dominion over the land and all the animals. So therefore, they had no property and no property rights. And then the Supreme Court comes along in 1823 and defines the Indians off their land. The Supreme Court says, you know, the Indians only have a quote-unquote right of occupancy. They're only tenants at will. On this land, they've been here for a millennia, you know. So in effect, we are the landlords and they're the tenants. And that is the attitude that prevails.
And the book is about the belief in property and the cost of that belief. And I think what's so important as one goes through the book is to realize how this dispossession of the Indians of really the use of the land that they had inhabited for millennia now has begun to apply to all of us in many ways. Not all of us, but many of us, maybe most. You begin the book with a farmer in New Hampshire telling you what's happening to his land. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I mean, we're far north New Hampshire, where you can look for miles and see mountains and mountains and mountains, and then you're looking into Canada. It's right at the top, the North Country. And there's this big project called Northern Pass, in which Hydro-Quebec, which is the largest power utility in all of North America, they've flooded an area the size of Germany up in Quebec to make hydropower. Has a lot of this and wants to bring it down to Massachusetts and other busy cities. Well, okay. But to do that, they want to bring these large transmission towers, like 14 stories tall, over the land, right through this farmer's land. And he says, no, wait a minute. No, you know, this land is who we are. They all keep offering him money. In fact, they offer him $4 million. And he says, no, not interested. My roots are deeper than your pockets. And what you have there is, in effect, once again, the farmer there is in the position of the Indians. He's now all of a sudden a tenant at will. He has to show why his pursuit of happiness should interfere with property in motion. And in fact, there's another thing that's said in American law, and this comes from an 1895 legal textbook, which it says, the quiet citizen must keep out of the way of the exuberantly active one. In other words, if you're happy on your land, you know, milking your cows or doing whatever you're doing, you have to make way for somebody with plans who has a railroad, a highway, a big project to go through. And all of a sudden, the burden of proof is on you to show why that project is not justifiable instead of the other way around. And I saw this over and over again when I'd be meeting with people. And it was that kind of pain, that kind of tumult that made me realize that whatever I was reporting on, whether it was the Northern Pass power lines or the big Kinder Morgan frack gas pipeline that was trying to come through Massachusetts, that this was about more than natural gas or kilowatts and power. It was about a fundamental American perception of property.
Well, that fundamental American perception of property started out with the ideal of the yeoman farmer, exactly somebody like your farmer in the North Country of New Hampshire. What made that change? In other words, who gets to define what is the proper use?
And well, that's exactly the question. Who gets to define? Who gets to decide? And that is what is being contested now by a lot of people. The entire country is going through kind of an upheaval, and that there are very large projects, almost even as the country deindustrializes, there's these large sort of industrial-scale projects suddenly being plopped down next to people's rural settings, whether it's these pipelines that have these enormous gas compression stations or some of these windmill farms, of which are enormous scale. And that question of who gets to decide comes right up. But when you go back and look through the law as it developed, particularly in the 19th century, to aid development of railroads and canals and then later highways, you see that it has always favored development, and development has had the right of way. Now, that had created a great deal of wealth for the community, but where that wealth ended up in the community was never an issue in the law. It was never considered. So what you had often is individuals who might probably be destroyed by the railroad coming through, and they're told, well, look, it's going to be really good for the whole community. So what happens is an individual ends up, against their will, subsidizing that project. And that's sort of that kind of inequality has continued on to this day.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author Howard Mansfield about his book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. It's about how American society treats property rights and who pays the price. You know, it's interesting. You mention, you talk about oil and gas pipelines on the one hand. You also, as you just mentioned, windmills. What do we do in a situation where, if we want to, you know, keep using electricity, we're going to have huge industrial installations of wind energy in order to save this farmer and every other farmer and possibly every human being and living being on the planet from catastrophic climate change? So, you know, is there a place where the community benefit does outweigh the individual benefit? How do we balance those rights?
Yeah, and that's the question. And it's really tough, and it's really going to be painful, and I think we're ahead for a lot more pain. I think one of the things to realize, just since I mentioned windmills, is that we don't really understand how industrial a complex they are. You know, it just sounds benign because it's wind. And if you go back, since I had mentioned railroads before, when railroads first started being built in the 19th century, they're being put everywhere until finally people realized what a big industrial kind of setting this was and got that sorted out. So these windmills have to find their place on the landscape, and we have to realize what is the total cost of this kilowatt if we're going to, you know, blast all these roads for access to these things and destroy ridge lines and destroy views. are there other ways to do this? And there always are, but by the time these things come up, those things have never been in the picture to start with.
Yeah, you talk also about the pipeline fight, and I know about this fight because I lived in Western Massachusetts for many, many years, and just before I left, it started heating up. This is the Kinder Morgan pipeline that came through upstate New York and then was supposed to go through Canada and right into your area in New Hampshire as well. Tell us about Lynn Placy and the fight against Kinder Morgan.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Now, Lynn Placy, she's actually up in the North Country, and she was a piano teacher who was fighting Northern Pass, the power lines. And Lynn, she's a 65-year-old widow with, you know, not much money, and she has like 40 or 50 piano students, and that's it for her income other than, you know, Social Security. And again, the Northern Pass Consortium, Hydro-Québec and Eversource in New Hampshire came and offered her a lot of money, and she said, nope, not going to sell anything. My allegiance is to this land for my children. My allegiance is to the North Country. My allegiance is to values that are more eternal than what you're after, and there are other ways to do this. And she became a huge hero up there, a huge hero for making her stand. She even had to raise money just to have her land surveyed because one of her nephews was selling his land, you know, that kind of thing. But she made a huge stand.
Well, that's right. So Lynn Placy was up there. But tell us about the Kinder Morgan, because that is a fascinating case of a company that came in and said, hey, basically, if you want electricity, if you want, you know, we need to be able to deal with peak demand. And I have to tell you, right here in Eastern Long Island, we're dealing with the same thing. When the utility wants to build a $750 million transmission line that's going to get its energy from dirty energy in order to meet something like 3 summer days of peak demand that out here on the east end of Long Island with all these millionaire and billionaire homes. And, you know, the community is saying, can't we avoid this by decreasing demand?
So, and there are, yeah, I'm sorry, there are, when you get into it, there are all sorts of ways that are seldom pursued by power companies to shave peak demand with this thing they call the duck curve or something. The curve that's supposed to be shaped like a duck, and it's that little bit of extra demand. And there are a lot of different ways to go about that, that they should pursue before they come in with a big project like that. But they're just kind of, their mindset is to go right in for the big project. So the Kinder Morgan pipeline, the assumptions there were greatly flawed. They just showed up in towns knocking on doors. In fact, there's one fellow, Vince Primus, he's going out one morning to go to work, and there's a guy in his driveway with a map and a bunch of papers. Oh, you know, by the way, this pipeline's going to come through 200 feet from your door. Sign here, sign here, sign here. And that's it. That's the first he ever heard of it. And this happened all over the place, town after town. What he did, what everyone did, is they quickly organized. They learned about the ins and outs of this energy policy. They learned who decided. They testified. They spoke to their representatives everywhere. They marched, and they won the day. It's a good example of how they were really model citizens. But basically, their lives became like the pipeline for 2 years. I mean, they had just took over their lives, a lot of people. Just a tremendous stress.
Well, they won the day, but at first they won the day by having the Kinder Morgan pipeline route being announced elsewhere.
Yeah, which wasn't their intent. That was just sort of a Kinder Morgan's way of trying to go forward. And then what happened is, even though this pipeline had been south of the New Hampshire border by just, you know, 10, 12 miles, it was complete news to everyone in these towns on the other side of the border, just completely disguised. And the whole process started all over again with people, you know, having up late at their computer learning about, you know, the FERC, which is the board that governs the decision-making and the energy policies and the whole thing. And it just started all over again until Kinder Morgan decided to go away for now.
And why did they decide to go away, do you think?
Well, you know, they said they didn't have enough customers. That's what they said. The reason why they said they were bringing this pipeline in was a shortfall of like some 20-odd days in one winter, and which was really, when you got into it, was really false, because there are all sorts of things going on there about the pipelines not being full, about the way gas was being bought, about all sorts of things to shape peak demand that weren't being done. So their case didn't hold up. So why exactly they went away, I only know the reason they said, for the record.
Mm-hmm. So now let's go back to a little bit of the development of the concept of property here. We talked about, you know, how Indians were defined as, you know, occupants but not owners. You took a long walk with the Tohono. How do I pronounce that?
Well, there's a number of pronunciations, but they favor Tohono O'odham. Their reservation, which is at the bottom of Arizona, is actually the size of Connecticut, which is kind of hard to imagine. You know, it's that kind of weird disparity. And I was out there in the desert walking with them for several days on their reservation, from village to village on their reservation. The Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum had organized this desert walk to revive the Tohono O'odham's, to revive their interest in native foods. They have tremendous problems. They have low income rate. They have one of the highest rates of adult onset diabetes because of this change in their diet, so forth and so on. And a lot of this all goes back to where the border is. I'm walking along one day, you know, in the desert, which, as you know, is completely different than northern New England, just as far as what everything looks like and what trees look like and how the desert is formed. And I realized, oh my gosh, I'm walking in the Gadsden Purchase. This is like a schoolboy kind of realization. Now, the Gadsden Purchase was the very last bit of land that was added to the continental United States during the presidency of Franklin Pierce in the 1850s. And it was bought solely to find a route for the Southern Transcontinental Railroad, solely for that. And that's how we learned it. And when we learned it on the map, it's a blank space. And the Americans regarded that, like Kit Carson said, you know, this land couldn't support a wolf. It couldn't support anything, although the Tohono O'odham, the desert people, had a desert agriculture that they had supported themselves for like 10,000 years, growing various beans and hunting small animals. But to them, it's sacred land. It's where their sacred peak is. They have the eldest people still know the stories that they used to sing to find their ways around the land. So all that was kind of coming back. So here you have this classic confrontation in how land is regarded. To us, it's a land deal. It's another blank space on the map. To Tohono O'odham, it was their homeland. It was their sacred land. And when that border was drawn, it completely broke up their native way of life, because they used to go south into Mexico to the Sea of Cortez, where there's another group of Indians, the Seri or the Comcoc, and they would intermarry, they would trade, they would go back and forth. And as the border hardened over the years, first for Hoof and Mouth and for other reasons, they lost that entire contact. And they also lost contact with their native agriculture. So all that is revealed just by looking at maps. And when you look at those old school maps that we had, and they would place like the names of the Sioux or the Pueblo Indians over the maps, you know, you'll notice that the names just kind of float over the top of the maps. It's almost as they don't have land, they don't have territory. It's just almost like clouds moving across the continent. So again, it just reveals our attitude. We tend to see boundaries, and we tend to overlook really the qualities of the land itself that are within that boundaries.
And then you spent some time talking about our first president, George Washington. I mean, talk about high crimes and misdemeanors. He walked right over the laws using every trick in the book. You know, tell us about the Dismal Swamp Company, which I think is very appropriately named.
You know, everyone has asked me about this. Everyone's like shocked at George Washington. George Washington started out with nothing. I mean, he didn't have corn to feed his horse. He became a surveyor, a very important occupation in the settling of the country. And he knew right off he was in Virginia, and Virginia was a particularly land-hungry empire. And the aristocracy of Virginia was into assembling huge acreages of land and then enslaving people to, you know, farm that land and to develop that land. So Washington knows right off that people are making money by buying the rich back countries, he says. So at a very young age, he buys 2,000 acres of land in the Shenandoah Valley, and he gets his start. And he goes off, he fights in the French and Indian War, and there are bounty lands awarded to the soldiers in what is now Ohio, in the Ohio Territory. And each soldier is entitled to a certain amount of land. And Washington goes and buys these rights from other people and uses fronts and beards, other people in front, so it's not Washington. Anyway, he ends up with like 30,000 acres, And there was very specific rules about how much river frontage you could have, so everybody could get the river washing, you know, small amounts, you know, just a whatever, a couple hundred acres along a river. And he ends up with like 30 miles of river frontage along one of the key rivers there. That's just one example. All the settlers, a lot of the settlers would buy something they call preemption rights, which was, even though the Indians are still on their land, they have the right, once the army comes through and moves them out, they're going to buy that land. So he deals in that too. So he is, you know, a huge landholder, and he was still broke, and a big slaveholder. He did free his slaves upon his death. Martha Washington didn't free her slaves. She actually couldn't under the laws of the time, but she wouldn't have anyway, I don't think, anyhow. So, yeah, he's a representative man in that way. So the Great Dismal Swamp is this huge, I think, 2,000-square-mile cypress swamp that right there, it crosses over with North Carolina and Virginia, the border. It's a vast thing. And Washington forms his company with some other people and buys 40,000 acres of swamp to drain the swamp, and he says they're going to farm there. The adventurers for draining the Dismal Swamp. And they never make any money, and they enslave a lot of people, and the slaves die, and it never makes any money during Washington's time. You have these poor slaves digging ditches by hand. And in fact, the oldest Washington monument in the country is this thing called Washington Ditch, which was built to help drain the swamp. Eventually, they build a canal, and they cut these ancient cypress trees, and they become the shingles that are used on the roofs in Philadelphia, Boston, and New York. So he was totally occupied in this idea of making land. That's what he wanted to do. That's a classic endeavor of the era.
We're talking with author Howard Mansfield about his book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. This is Writer's Voice. So making land, which is really actually a fiction, it's a legal fiction. It has, you say at one point in this book, that property is legal right to draw a boundary and exclude others. And each boundary severs what was once whole. Each line drawn across the land reorders the world and buries history. Property is made by boundaries, but the earth is a totality.
Yeah, and that's the ecological view. If you have an ecological view, if you understand how things are working, then boundaries are artificial. Boundaries are an artificial way to look at the world. And one of the problems we're having with climate change is that we're very boundary obsessed, and we don't realize the way that everything works in totality. So land and property, in a lot of ways, are sometimes just different things. Property is our way of seeing it, our limited way of seeing it.
And property is now, of course, being extended to more and more things. Colonialism, the history of colonialism, of course, is the history of taking over other people's property. But now you have these huge land grabs all over the world by countries like China. Saudi Arabia is buying up farmland in the United States. I mean, what's going to happen when we have a hugely stressed agriculture due to climate change, and whatever productive capacity of the land is owned by Saudi Arabia, not the U.S. And you also talk about things like mineral rights, you know, where people can own the property on top of the land, but not underneath the land. So this is just, it seems like a really insane notion that property has run amok in the idea of the definition of what it is.
Well, you know, if that's your reaction, then I think that's great, because I did want people to think, God, this is just very strange. You know, and when you actually start reading the philosophical history of property and why do we have property, and you find out there's no real great justification for it. Either this is God's plan, property was, this is the way the world is, or the property exists because of the state, and the state exists to protect property, but it's all very circular. And so it's a good thing to question, absolutely. And you talked about the mineral rights. We have over 50 eastern national forests that were east of the Mississippi that were established by the Weeks Act in 1911. Huge piece of legislation. And how that came about was the White Mountains here in New Hampshire, now the White Mountain National Forest, had been logged over so bad that there were tremendous fires and huge runoff. And you look at the old photos of some of these mountainsides, they look like Antietam and Gettysburg after the battle, just totally beat. And what was happening was downriver, down the Merrimack River, was flooding from the runoff and shutting down the Amiskeag Mill, the largest mill in cotton mill and a textile mill in the world at the time. So finally, after like 40 congressional votes that they lost over 10 years, these reformers, they found the open sesame, the words to save this land. And it wasn't for forest practices. It wasn't for ecology. It wasn't for recreation. It wasn't for scenery. It was for property. They could save these lands to protect property downstream. They could protect the headwaters just for that reason. So they found the open sesame to create this vast treasure for all of us. But within the, some of the within the national parks, and particularly some of them out in Pennsylvania in near the Marshall, in the shale fields, there are mineral rights that were not bought. And under the law, mineral rights are considered to be dominant. That's the expression. So I can go in, even though you own the land, I can go in and just go right in there and start drilling for my gas or my oil or my mining. So again, even though we have this great achievement, the Weeks Act and National Forests, it's astonishing, like 50% of land held within national forests, some of them, are private. So again, you get this great checkerboard and this great back and forth between public good and private wealth.
And tell us what's happening to public lands right now. I mean, it's not just Trump that is doing this, but the process has really accelerated. These are public lands that are supposed to be, public. They are part of the inheritance of every single person living in the United States.
Well, if you read the news from day to day, as you know, about the Bears Ear National Monument being radically reduced, about drilling rights being opened up and threatening all sorts of endangered animals, opening up land in the Arctic National Refuge to drill, opening up land off the coast. So there's a rapid, you could call it essentially a land rush, a gold rush, a grab as fast as they can to take what are public lands and sell the rights for nothing and open it up to extraction, which I don't know. I don't think a lot of people voted for that. Out west, they've always complained about how much of federal lands are owned in their state. But this is really against the public interest.
Mm. Well, Howard Mansfield, this is such an important book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. It's beautifully written as well. Thank you so much for talking with us again on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about Mansfield and his other writings. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.